This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geeks, show number 221, recorded on July 9th, 2015.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff. The final liftoff of Atlantis.
Here at Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way in your home. News, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the Average Tech Guy. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in just a beautiful Bellevue, Nebraska. We've had just a series of a week of just some great weather and low humidity. It's really nice. Mike, it's pretty good in Nebraska right now, right?
Oh, it's absolutely perfect. We're going to a wedding and boating this weekend, so just a few more days I needed to hold out. We'll be solid. So
super, super nice. And, of course, we post the show with world-class show notes each week out at theaverageguy.tv. If you have questions, comments, or contributions, you can contact the show. Send me an email, jim@theaverageguy.tv. You can track me down on Twitter, @jcollison. I think I'm actually going to ditch the phone number. We've tried that now for, I don't know, half a year, maybe 9 months. Maybe I won't. If you want to call us, because we do have some calls tonight, so maybe I'll leave it out there, 402-478-8450. Play your messages. I got a couple tonight, so we'll leave it out there, and we'll see. You guys keep calling in. It's a great way to get your questions in, and you do that. Of course, theaverageguy.tv is powered by Maple Grove Partners Web Hosting. Get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from people you know and trust. You know that's Christian, and for more information on that, you can check it out. Plans start at $10 a month, maplegrovepartners.com. And apparently, I was causing some network problems with my site. Theaverageguy.tv was causing some issues on Maple Grove Partners, and Christian's got that all straightened out. So it's good to know your IT guys. That's the best part about Maple Grove Partners. Check that out, maplegrovepartners.com. I want to thank Roger over at WLMN Radio. And, of course, they stream us live out there in Grafton, West Virginia. And if you're listening from there, we'd still like to hear from you, so send us a note. Mike, I don't think we've ever heard from anybody, have we?
Not yet.
It's questionable if anybody's listening to that radio station. But
they just don't like our show. It's okay.
Maybe they don't. Like, who are these guys?
Yeah.
So, anyways, if you're listening in Grafton, West Virginia, we'd love to have you. Contact us. Home Gadget Geeks is a part of the Geeks Network. And actually, Mike, we just added your show to the Geeks Network. So
yeah,
if you head out there to open mic night. And do you have some new album art coming in addition to the new stuff that you gave me?
Yeah, so basically I know personally my design people, and we were going back and forth, and I didn't think they had anything, so I just whipped one together. And But yes, now we have the final version coming over.
Okay, and some new website stuff going on, right?
All new stuff over at Open Mic Night. Everything's new.
OMN Podcast, and that's now part of the Geeks Network. You can get this show, that show, and a whole bunch of others at the Geeks Network.
For about one more week. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Oh, no,
the URL is going to be good for about one more week, and then we're switching everything
some
up.
Some changes going on as well. But Geeks, it's all out at thegeeksnetwork.com.
Exactly. Good way to find
it. You bet. You can join us in chat, watch or listen live on YouTube or on Spreaker or Mixler. All the navigation that you need is available over at theaverageguy.tv. All right, we got through that. I want to welcome Dustin Tower to our program tonight. Dustin, welcome to Home Gadget Geeks.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Good to have you on. And, of course, Dustin, if anyone has ever watched the videos that I do at work, especially around tech, when we go to InfoTech, which is these are both conferences here in Omaha, InfoTech or Heartland Developer Conference, the consistency in all those 3 years is I've interviewed you every time.
I know. It's pretty much a standing, you know, got to find Jim, got to pencil in some time to go talk to him.
I really enjoyed it. If you go back on the channel and you just Google Dustin on that, you can see the three or four, I think we've done four of those, maybe five at this point. And it's always good to interview you. And this year, we just did that a couple months ago. Seems like it was just yesterday, but a couple months ago. I said, Dustin, we just got to get you on the show. So thanks for saying yes, and thanks for coming on Home Gadget.
Yeah, this was perfect. I'm excited to do it.
We're going to catch up with you in a second, but before we kind of get some info on you, we did have some callers that called in. Normally I save this to the end, but I thought that this would be fun because not everybody gets to the end. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to throw these calls in up front. And so give me a second here. And the first one, Kevin Schoonover is really good about about calling us. So let me set up Kevin and listen to this call.
Hey, Jim. Kevin here. I've got an observation, and I appreciate you keeping an archive of older information. It seems like as of late, I have been linking people to the Average Guy's Windows 8 Know It Guide quite frequently. And it seems, you know, a lot of folks at work, either their spouses or family members buying a new laptop, and they end up with a Surface or a X360 or some other two-in-one yoga-type device. And frankly, as much as we've beat the Windows 8.1 horse to death, a lot of folks are just buying their first Windows 8 product. If you think about the buying cycle, it surprised me a little bit at first, but most folks are quite happy with their two-in-one devices, just learning that Alt-Tab is your best friend in Windows 8, just like in Windows 7. So I just wanted to give my tip for the night is that Windows 8 Know It Guide is alive and well and in demand, and it's a great reference to send folks in and around your circle that are finally making the hop to a new device and need Windows 8 support. Have a great rest of the week, and we'll talk to you later.
So what Kevin is referring to is three years ago, when Windows 8 was coming out, I put together one of these Know It guides, and actually we called it a survival guide for a while, and it's had a couple different iterations, but it ended up being a Know It guide. If you go out to theaverageguy.tv now, I've actually changed all that. So Kevin's call inspired me to actually create a new site. It's a site I'd had actually a couple years ago that I let go and then I bought again. And so if you go to Know It, K-N-O-W, Know It, I-T, Guy, G-U-Y, .com, knowitguy.com. Brand new site, all the Know It guides that I've put together. We've got one on cloud storage, one on Windows 8, the one he was talking about, one on Windows 10 that I'm writing right now. We're going to talk a little bit about Windows 10 here in a second. And then I have one for the Amazon Echo. And so basically did a summary for the Echo, and then I've been keeping track of all the release notes, because those are the hardest to find, actually, when new features. Mike, you're new to the Echo. When new features come out, you get an email, but you kind of don't always know what's going on, right?
Totally, yeah.
So it's one of those things. Dustin, have you jumped on the Echo bandwagon yet? Do you have a...
I haven't, but I do know the pain of keeping up with release notes when a new version comes out and you have to figure out what's exactly different or what you're supposed to know about.
So we're trying out this new idea. It's kind of an offshoot of theaverageguy.tv. It's just called Know It Guy. Mm-hmm. Not the Know It Guy, but knowitguy.com. You can check those out. And those guides are there. And we spell guide G-U-Y-D-E, right, to kind of play on those words. And so, Kevin, thanks for that. He's still using the Windows 8 version, which I went back. I was like, holy cow, I haven't updated that in forever. So it's awesome that there's still a lot of good links in it. And then I started a Windows 10 one. So if you guys want to interact with us on that, interact with me on that, the best way is to do that through the Facebook group. And if you haven't joined the Facebook group, you want to do that, just go to facebook.com/groups/ The Average Guy TV gets you there as well. You can jump in the group and a lot of good tech conversation. I'd love to hear back from you on Windows 10. Dustin, speaking of Windows 10, you're kind of a mobile developer in the mobile space. Mm-hmm. How big is Windows 10 playing into your kind of your thoughts and processes right now? Are you even worried about it?
You know, not really, especially because of the browser that's coming with Windows 10. And, you know, Microsoft has basically become one of the leaders in browser support and standards, which is kind of funny. I saw a tweet last week that someone said that Safari's the new Internet Explorer because Apple's been very unfriendly with how they want to support standards as you're building, web applications. And IE, or you know, the new Microsoft browser, is phenomenal. It supports all kinds of new APIs and is very standards compliant, and Microsoft's kind of done a 180 in the way that they've approached, you know, the way that they build their browser. So, you know, a lot of the focus on mobile and tablets and all of those, the plethora of devices that we work with is really from the web standpoint, and having websites that will work and give the consistent user experience across all of them. And it's a lot easier to deliver that kind of experience with a browser that supports, you know, the latest and greatest standards.
Yeah, so you're referring to Edge, right? And,
yep.
And Project Spartan, which is still early. We talked about this on Surface Geeks on Tuesday. Edge is still early. There's a lot of questions about plugin support and some of those kinds of things. But what you're saying is, at least in the framework standpoint, a very solid framework that they're building on top of. to make that compliant. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And you know, really, because I think, you know, we've over the past, you know, say, you know, 5-6 years, we've been really focused on app development, and that's been kind of the key to mobile, is, you know, building an app that works on a platform that you're targeting. But that's slowly transitioning to just building websites that work. You know, there was a funny quote that someone said that, you know, they have this dream to build an app that will be available on your phone when you need it and will get deleted from your phone when you're not using it. So it doesn't take up any space, it doesn't take up any resources, it's there when you need it, it's gone when you don't need it. And that's actually a web page, because that's what you do, is you pull up the browser, you go to a web page, it does what you want it to do, you close the browser, and it's gone. It's not on your machine anymore. And so, you know, really where we want to get to is a point where, you know, we've got offline sites that work. So if you do not have internet connectivity, you've got an offline version of the web app essentially saved on your device, and the devices are smart enough to, when you launch it, just like you launch a application, you will just get the offline version of it.
Cool. We got a little helper back there, do we?
Yeah. She obviously hears something that...
It's all good. Yeah. It's all good. There's a squirrel outside.
Yeah.
Well, I did not anticipate you saying that, to be honest. When you said that Edge is, like, great, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's been... I'm not saying it hasn't been good. It's just early, right? I mean, I think we're all still very early in that, and so
absolutely,
I'm a little surprised.
Well, and there's, you know, there's a difference between the, you know, stability of a browser and how it performs on the operating system, and, you know, the APIs, the HTML5, CSS3 APIs, and JavaScript APIs that it supports. And that's really where I come from. I'm not worried about how it performs on the operating system, because that's, you know, beta software, it'll work itself out, you know, that can be fixed pretty easily. But a browser that will support the latest and greatest, you know, offline APIs, you know, Canvas APIs, WebGPL, all of those things are what Edge absolutely supports. And Microsoft has kind of leaped forward in, you know, a browser that for years, you know, as a web developer, we have made fun of. We've always been like, oh, I got to support IE7. Oh, my God, you know. And now it's, you know, when it's out there and in the wild, it's really going to be an afterthought, because it's going to be along the same lines of Chrome and Firefox and, you know, some of the browser vendors that have always been progressive in the way that they've supported.
Well, that's the hard part, too, because there's give and take on all these. So when people first get their Mac and I'm kind of telling them about things, I said, you know what, use Safari until you encounter something that doesn't work, and then have Chrome waiting, because Safari, you get great performance and everything like that, but every single day you'll encounter something that it doesn't work on. Just like you said, you know, it breaks on certain things, doesn't support certain activities. And so I always tell people, I'm like, well, use it first. And even for Hangouts, I use Safari because, I mean, my CPU and my memory are saved a lot by using Safari, but... you know, I don't get a lot of the benefits that Chrome offers. So, but yeah, I haven't played with Edge. That's exciting to know that Edge is going to offer all that support.
Well, when you mean benefits, you mean over CPU utilization, you mean high memory usage, those kind of benefits using Chrome?
Or just being able to use the internet, you know, whatever benefits. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
It's such a weird place, Dustin, right now, because Chrome, as good as it was, and everybody flocked to it, continues to be... kind of dragged down with performance issues as of late. And of course, as we do these hangouts, they're great, but they are hogs. I mean, they're just terrible at doing some of those kinds of things. And I've used IE in place of Chrome sometimes on devices that are struggling, because the plugins seem to be what's kind of consuming a ton. But you know, it to me, it seems like Chrome is getting hit a lot as well from some of these kind of same problems that Firefox had before that and IE had before that.
You hit it right on the head, because, you know, back in the, you know, early 2000s when Firefox hit the scene, you know, that was the hot new browser. And we, you know, it was fast. It just was, like, beautiful to use. And then there started getting all these add-ons for it, and it started building in all these other hooks, and then it just kind of got slow. And then all of a sudden Chrome hit the scene. And, you know, Chrome was a browser that was wicked fast right away, and it would, you know, you'd hit the button and boom, it would pop up, and you were instantly surfing, and you know, now it kind of slows itself down, and, you know, some of that is, you know, people who've got, you know, 50 icons in the upper right-hand corner of their Chrome browser with pop-up blockers, and, you know, I've got Live Reload, I got YSlow, I got Edge Inspect for doing mobile development, you know, so I've got these plugins that are sitting there, and I know it's my fault that I might have a slower version of Chrome because they're running there, but there's other things like the developer tools and underneath the hood features that they're trying to build in that end up slowing down the browser. And Chrome, like Firefox, doesn't have the luxury that Safari and IE have of being able to really leverage some of the operating system, you know, for performance, because, you know, Apple, because they make the OS, they can make Safari work really fast with it. And same thing from the Microsoft side with Edge.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting day that we get to when we talk about browsers, and we haven't talked about browsers on this show in a long time. I think most people default to Chrome now at this point. Interesting to hear, you know, with Windows 10 and build 166 as of tonight is the most current build for Windows 10. That is out. That came out this afternoon. I actually downloaded that onto the Surface or updated on the Surface and my VM as well. But 162, which had been the build before it, I had been working with Edge a little bit. I'm particularly interested in Edge because it supports writing devices, right? It you can draw on that and save them and send them out. And while that seems a little gimmicky at first, from a design issue, from being able to do stuff quickly on the tablet, write it out, and then shoot it out to people. Hey, I want this. I'm looking for that. Yeah. under right. There's some, if you can make that work, it never worked right up until 162. So it has just started working right in Edge. I think we still got some ways to go, but good to hear that we have a fairly hopeful browser coming from Microsoft.
Well, and you know, like I mentioned, I come from the perspective of a web developer who has to build, you know, applications that support or are, you know, that work in the browser. And you know, there's a website called html5test.com that will, you know, it'll test your browser, but also has a tab to look at other browsers. And it what it does is it gives them a score, and it's scoring them based on all of the features that they support. And again, these features are the HTML5 and CSS3 kind of WC3 standards that have been approved by the World Wide Web Consortium, and, you know, take browsers a little bit of time. And to put it in perspective, the scores for the current version of Chrome is 526, and that's the leader. Firefox is 467. Internet Explorer 11 is 336. And Internet Explorer, or I should say Microsoft Edge right now, is 402. So Edge is a huge leap above IE 11 in what they support. And Safari, the current version of Safari, is 396. So it's actually behind Edge as far as web APIs that they support. And that again is kind of the cool thing that I like what Microsoft is doing with their browsers. They've said, we need to make our browser progressive. We need to make it, you know, a browser that supports the latest, you know, APIs that can keep up with technology and won't be something that lags behind.
No, that's very cool. That's actually a great tool. You're always good at that. Whenever I have you, you know, the last time we were together, we were talking about that browser developer tool available to test. You know, Google was just starting to penalize people, right, for that.
Yep.
And we actually put my site in, and I found, and it didn't. It wasn't, and you added some.
And then we fixed it quick.
you fixed it, so it'd be okay. What I found out later was in the theme. So the theme I had not been updated yet. I've updated the most current theme, and of course it works in the updated theme, which was fine. But you were kind enough to jump in there and get that done. Ken from the chat room is asking, so right now is your recommendation for browser Chrome? I mean, if you're talking about the average guy, maybe even the average tech guy, is Chrome still the place to be right now?
My personal feeling on that is yes. I would not argue if somebody likes to go with a Firefox over Chrome, or, I mean, truthfully, even a Safari. The thing that I always vote for is, you know, if you've got a Gmail account, Chrome should be your default browser, because not only is Chrome gonna like have a lot more support for some of the, you know, Google Inbox and some of the, you know, Hangout features and things that you will use in the Google umbrella, but you're going to get tab synchronization between your desktop and your phone. You know, if you log into Chrome on another machine, all your bookmarks are going to be there. You know, and Firefox has those kinds of features from, you know, shared bookmarks and that kind of thing. But, you know, I kind of live in the Google ecosystem, you know, and so the browser being there makes a lot of sense.
Mike, for you, as a Mac guy using Safari full-time, I assume, are you kicking onto Chrome, or where are you at?
Yeah, no, just like I said earlier, I stay onto Chrome as much as I can just because the performance is a lot better, a lot less of a hog on my CPU. And then in those rare circumstances, I'll kick over to Chrome. But honestly, I use a lot of apps. I mean, really, when I'm hopping on the web, I mean, Facebook maybe, and then a few other things, but I'm not doing too much on this computer as far as web browsing. I'm honestly just editing audio, doing editing video, doing that sort of stuff. So not too much intensive things on the web where I would need a really good beefy web browser.
Okay. Dustin, is the day of the browser? I mean, we have these desktop, the browser primarily in the context of the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
The desktop is shrinking, I think, right?
Absolutely.
It's contracting. What is that? So as we think about a browsing on the mobile device, is the browser as important because of what Mike just said? He's going to apps.
Mm-hmm.
So on the mobile space, how important is that browser, and what are you seeing in that mobile space along those lines? Do we need to be as worried?
I actually think the browser on the mobile side is going to be taking business away from the apps on the mobile side because, you know, again, the last thing that I want to do is have to download an app. And there's a little difference, you know, when you're talking Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and, you know, some of the social media apps and those kinds of things, those are mainstays for you to aggregate content. But, you know, when there was a stat that came out a few months ago, over, I believe it's 60% of mobile users don't download any app or download one app or less a month. So, you know, that's literally like, and if you look at yourself, like how many times do you actually download a new app? You know, you get a new phone, you kind of pull everything down that you use, but like how often do you really go and download new apps? You know, aside from, you know, maybe playing around, like looking for a game to eat up some time or whatever, but, you know, we really sit in our, you know, our main apps, Facebook, Twitter, the mail app, you know, whatever, and then the browser. The browser is sort of our key to the outside world. And when you're in Facebook and somebody posts a link, one of the issues that mobile developers deal with is context switches. And so when you click a link in Facebook, Facebook is going to open that link in sort of an embedded web browser within the app. It's called a web view. And to the average user, you don't really care. You're seeing the website now, but you're seeing a website in a browser within an app, which isn't always the best experience. Like, I would rather be in the native browser on that phone, but phones don't do a great job of switching back and forth. So, and we probably all had this experience where we click a link, we are launched over into the browser, we're done in the browser, so now we have to kind of task switch ourselves back to the app to get back to where we are. So there's these context switches that are really annoying, and we're used to this on the desktop now because new tab opens, close a tab, back in the old tab. But we have kind of the dexterity on the desktop to jump back and forth. Mobile devices haven't been as eloquent. And that's why really the perfect ecosystem, you know, which is years away still, but we have no apps on the phone. Like everything is delivered via the browser. And we have offline caching of web applications. So when you're on the LinkedIn site, it's actually caching the resources for that site on your phone. So if you ever pull it open to look at, you know, something after the fact, and you don't have internet connection, it'll use the offline version of the site. When you have internet, it'll download the latest version of the site. And now you all of a sudden have apps without apps because you still have the offline capability, but it's smart enough to know if it's online or not, and everything is in a single context.
So from a developer standpoint, how far away are we from, so we talk about, you know, power, efficiency, speed of writing the apps and being able to have that direct kind of coding to the device as compared to something you have to develop for a browser that's being used by a bunch of different devices. You know, how, is that extremely difficult at this point, and how close are we to be able to have those get closer and closer to being actually about the same?
Well, and that's exactly, you know, the paradox that is kind of here, because, you know, when you build an app, you know, you start out with that decision. Okay, do I want to target iOS? Do I want to target Android? Do I want to target Windows? And there are some great platforms like PhoneGap or Xamarin and that allow you to build your app once and publish it to multiple platforms all at once, so you have that same code base. But the web is the code base of, well, wait, I just put up a website and everybody can see it. The trouble is those capabilities like offline caching of web applications, that's not supported in every browser. There's a website, if you're a web developer or you're just kind of curious in capabilities, there's a website called caniuse.com, like caniuse.com, caniuse.com, that will show you different capabilities like offline cache and what browsers support them. So, for example, if you wanted to use offline cache, it's not supported in IE9 or before. So if your user base is in IE9, you know you can't save a website offline, you know, with, you know, in that user base. But we're probably, you know, a year or two away from being able to just globally kind of adopt those kinds of things. The cool thing about, you know, the way that Edge is moving, Chrome and Firefox have been there for years, is they are updating nightly. They're updating, you know, weekly, and they have these kind of background updates where as they begin to support some of these new APIs that are becoming standard, we'll all of a sudden have that support in the market.
Gotcha. Yeah, very cool. And so, Mike, how do you feel about, as a Mac guy, how do you feel about Safari at this point? I mean, as you're looking at that, I know you talked about you're using Chrome mostly, but as the Mac guy, how do you hold Apple accountable? I mean, have they kind of abandoned the browser?
I don't know. Okay, so every single keynote you see from Apple, any, you know, talking about any sort of software update they had, the WWDC that we just had from them, they're going to tout how Safari is faster, better, and the performance is a lot better. And which is true, it does get a lot snappier, faster, things like that, you know, but just like Dustin was saying, there's a lot of things it can't do. There's a lot of just features that it can't do. I just ran the test on the HTML5 test, and it's, you know, like 200 and some on mine. I don't know why. And Safari, and Chrome just brought up 526, just like Lopped in the chat said, mine did the same thing. So I hold them accountable a little bit, but also there's a lot of other options out there for me. So when I have other options, it's not as big of a deal for me.
Sure.
And so since I have
Because you have Chrome.
Yeah, exactly. Because I have Chrome, there's Firefox, there's other things out there that you can use. And so I'm not too upset about it. And honestly, for about 90% of my work, Safari works just fine. Yeah. I'm using Safari for this Hangout right now. I'm using Safari for the chat room. I haven't had to hop out of it yet. So for the most part, it works.
Couple things from the chat room. One, Edge only available in Windows 10. They're not going to backport that to any other version of Windows. Mm-hmm. And then two, Dustin, when I in Windows 10, when I'm invoking Edge, and I know it's early, is that going well? Let's talk about Windows Phone 8 first. Those mm-hmm. apps invoking the IE on that browser, as opposed to, because those integrations are so tight, is that the way it works on Windows Phone 8?
Yeah. So and this is actually a consistent thing across most mobile platforms, is that the mobile platform allows applications to embed the phone's browser within the application. And that was that WebView thing that I talked about. And, you know, so again, if you're in your Facebook app or, you know, anything, and you click it and you're still in the Facebook app, but you're looking at an actual web page, they aren't, you know, the app isn't making its own browser, because that would just be like horrible. You know, that, I mean, there's only a small amount of browser vendors out there, and that's for a reason. It's because it's a very hard thing to do. So we would rather leverage the browser on the device. And that, again, leads to more issues of, you know, an older phone that maybe the phone doesn't have, you know, like in Android's case, you know, we had a lot of fragmentation on the Android platform. That's a tough platform to develop for. It's a lot better now than it was 2 or 3 years ago, just because most people are, you know, on the latest version of Android or only one version removed. But, you know, a few years ago, you know, we would look at the Android operating system and it was everything from, you know, ice cream sandwich and jelly bean and gingerbread. I mean, users were all over the board, and the stock browser on Android, it was all over the board in what it supported, and so some users just didn't have a great web experience because the browser was really old and couldn't be updated because you had to update to the next version of Android to get the new browser. And so Windows is a lot better ecosystem because they're able to leverage, that's kind of the point of Edge. I'm not sure what Edge's support is going to be, you know, how far back on devices or, you know, what devices will support it, but that's part of the reason they're building it, is they're building it to work across desktop, tablet, phone, and, you know, everything in between.
So in today's, we haven't talked about browser security in this, and from what you know as a developer for this, that's been an issue. I mean, we just haven't, it hasn't hit the news a lot lately. Is that still a big concern when we think about the browsers and security and some of those things that the average user needs to be worried about?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the average user for sure, I think the average user is becoming more and more aware of security things that they never had to consider before. You know, I mean, everybody kind of preaches, you know, look for the green HTTPS in the web browser now, and, you know, telling, you know, us as, you know, developers, like, we know we got to make our site secure, but telling users to look to make sure your website is secure is a weird thing to ask them, because shouldn't it be secure? Like, shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't really have to be worrying about that. But, you know, I think the issue really is that developers can't keep up with the security holes that are being created, and it's partially because browsers are being developed at a faster pace, so zero-day exploits show up all the time, and, you know, a zero-day exploit is something that's already out in the wild that, you know, could have absolutely taken your information, or, you know, the developers haven't had time to fix because they just found out about it too late. But I think as an average user, it really becomes the point, it's like, you know, checking to see if your door is locked at night when you go to bed. Like, check that browser bar and make sure at a minimum, if you're on a website that is doing anything transactionally, whether it's, you know, credit card information, login information, I mean, even submitting your email address, you know, to a, you know, subscribe to a newsletter, that site needs to be, you know, a secure site. And there's, you know, we talked about this at our podcast in Omaha when I was in there or down there, that Google is downranking sites that aren't secure now. That's another part of their algorithm. Not only are they downranking if you're not mobile friendly, but they're also downranking if you're not secure, because every site should be secure, whether it's the most basic site or whether, you know, you're selling information or selling products.
Does that matter for a blog? I mean, so I've got, Christian has made, he's my web guy. He's, the averageguy.tv is secure at this point, but I, mm-hmm. you know, the knowitguy.com, I just threw that up there. It's unsecure. It mm-hmm. it passed the, well, I don't want to say unsecure. That makes it sound. It's, yeah. It's, how do you say that without making it sound bad, right?
It doesn't use SSL.
It does not use SSL. And is that a bad thing from, I mean, it's just a blog, right, mm-hmm. from that standpoint. Is that a bad deal that I'll get downranked a little bit from Google for that? But how bad is that for
you? Yeah, I, you know, the downranking that occurs, Google is still smart enough to know, like, if your content's relative, so it's not going to, like, stash you in the basement just because you're not secure if somebody is, you know, searching for content on your site. The only thing to be concerned about really is the login, because, you know, if it's a blog where, you know, you're logging into it or users have to log in to comment. If it's not secure, technically, if you're on a Wi-Fi connection, that's at a coffee shop or, you know, anywhere else that it isn't a, you know, VPN or private network, someone could be seeing those passwords going over the air. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot of, it's not much very fancy software to have to do that nowadays. So, you know, again, it's, you know, if you're not having hundreds of thousands of transactions, it's not that big of a deal, but it is something that is a vulnerability.
You kind of backed me into a corner a little bit because, right, so we use Chatwing as our chat mm-hmm. service provider. Those have accounts that people have to log into, Facebook, mm-hmm. Twitter, those kinds of things. When Chatwing changed some of their pricing, they went from $1 a month charging me for SSL support mm-hmm. to $20 a month. Now, mm-hmm. That's a lot for SSL, right? To 20 bucks mm-hmm. to go from $1 to 20 was a lot. Now, they backed it down to 10 bucks. That's still a lot. So I kind of said, screw you, Chatwing. I'm going to – so I created a separate subsite that's HTTP. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the live page that has the Chatwing player that's running HTTP on it. Is that a problem for my users? I mean, they're logging in to Chatwing every time they come in. Is that an issue? Should I figure out a new way to do it so they're on a secure page?
Yeah, you know, it depends a little bit on how Chatwing's integrated, because, you know, if Chatwing's in an iframe, like, it might be embedded on your site using HTTPS. So it has a secure connection between its embedded page and where it's going to be sending the data or submitting the data. And, you know, if it's submitting the data over SSL, you know, for, like, you know, anonymous or, like, you know, really, really good hackers, like, there's probably still a way to get in there, but you're still, you know, probably okay, like, for the most part, what you're doing. But if, you know, again, if even if they're using SSL in the Chatwing pod, if it's embedded on an unsecure page, there's still ways technically that you can, you know, do some script injection or some various, you know, like, again, they're very, I don't even really know most of the things that happen. I just know that the rule of thumb is everything HTTPS, and, you know, you're okay. But again, things like Chatwing, which are actually on a separate server, tend to be a little bit better because they have a secure socket layer that they're embedded under.
Yeah. Well, it's, I guess I have something to think about along those lines. It's like, yeah, you know, they're razzing me a little bit about Chatwing in Chatwing. They're using Chatwing to razz me about Chatwing. So
that's I saw there's a comment from Andy there about, you know, using authentication, like OAuth from something else. And that's a really good point, that a lot of people, you know, who are trying to do member management and logins on their site, but, you know, they don't want to have to manage a database of user information. They don't want to have to worry about, you know, information being stolen during the login process. So what they do is they utilize Facebook or Google or Twitter as their, you know, and we see these on sites everywhere, like log in with your Google account, log in with your Facebook account, log in with your Twitter account. A lot of times that's because they don't even want to worry about usernames on your end. They just want, hey, just use your Google account to log in. Google manages the login, then they take care of all of that authentication, and then, you know, this is beyond, you know, average guy technical stuff, but they give you a little token back so that you can remember the logged in user on the site, you know. So but the secure information is handled by Google or Twitter or Facebook, not by your domain.
Yeah. All right. Well, so it's some good info, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we have quite a few podcasters that listen to us, Mike being one of those, although Mike uses an IRC client to get his done. And I hate your chat, man. Mike, I cannot take your chat.
It's in the works to be redone, actually. When we're doing this whole website switch, you know, it's been one of those things. There's that ad banner on the top. It's awful.
Oh, I just can't. I know it's old school, and I know some guys love that old school IRC stuff, but I just can't take it. And if I had a good, viable alternative to Chatwing, we'd be moving pretty quickly away from it, and I'd even pay a couple bucks a month. I mean, it was just nice. It was $1 a month, and I liked that, and that was working perfectly. And then they screwed it all up with the because it was a la carte pricing, and then they moved to not a la carte pricing. Dustin, I want to ask you a little bit about the state. And so before I do that, hold on. Phil also called me as well. Phil, hang on. If you're listening to the show, you know you called me because you're the only Phil from the UK that called me. We're going to play your question is significantly different than what we're talking about. So we'll play that at the end of the show. So hang on. Dustin, state of the mobile development today, when we think about, I mean, we're kind of at that place where I think mobile development a couple years ago was like Windows 95, Windows 98 days, when it was just crazy, right? People were developing all kinds of crap, and the standards weren't the best, and stuff was hard-coded, and, you know. I feel like with mobile development, we're getting to that place today. It's getting much more stable, much more standardized. We're getting – am I wrong in that? I mean, are we getting a little more mature in the mobile place? And
yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, the – you know, I mentioned a little earlier about how, you know, the ultimate goal is to just be able to make web apps that will work, you know, on a mobile device, and you don't even need apps because it just works in the browser. But we're a ways from that, and so building apps is still a way to deliver – better performing content. If you're making a game, you know, just the mobile browsers sometimes just can't handle the amount of power that's needed to make a, you know, highly interactive or 3D graphics game. Same thing for offline connectivity. You know, it's nice to be able to pull open your mail app when you don't have an internet connection, compose some emails, and then when you got an internet connection, they go off. So apps are still very important. The trouble from a development standpoint is picking your platforms to target. as I mentioned earlier, the really cool thing, I kind of call it, it's the age of the transpilers. And so, and what I mean by that is there are a lot of really, really sophisticated tools that allow you to develop a single application and publish it to multiple mediums. Because right now, if you want to make a iOS app, you're supposed to use Xcode. That's Apple's developer tools. You write in Objective-C, although they've got this new language called Swift now, which is a lot better because Objective-C is, by my personal opinion, it's really bad. it's a painful language to write in. If you're going to make an Android app, you're going to write in Java. You're going to use Android Studio to do that. But those are two completely different development processes and development cycles, and that companies can't afford to do that. They can't afford to develop simultaneous apps. So what a lot of them have done is they've gone the route of using, Adobe's got a platform called PhoneGap, which allows you to write HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and it packages it as a native app. So you can take advantage of camera, you can take advantage of GPS, you can do all those things, but you're just using web technology to do it. To the end user, it looks like a regular app. Xamarin is a platform that a third-party company made, but it uses C#, which is kind of the .NET platform. And so you can literally take .NET code that you've written and convert that using Xamarin into Windows apps, into Android apps, into iOS apps. It's a really, really sophisticated platform, and it allows developers to get more reach within the app ecosystem, because we don't have to just pick the most popular platform or the one platform that's the easiest to develop for. And that's really what's cool about where we're at right now, is you can kind of, whatever language you know, there's probably a way to get your, you know, code into an app form and probably, you know, into, you know, various platforms as well.
So are there, on the opposite end of that, are there, you know, I can write my code and then all of a sudden there's something that'll make it so that on all the different browsers, you know, you're covered no matter what browser they're in. Hey, it'll work to this. Because, I mean, if we're moving towards this whole all-browser system, we're probably going to move towards that, right?
Absolutely. And that's actually, you know, that's what we've been doing forever on the web is, you know, oh, I got this really sweet web app and it looks awesome in Firefox, but, oh, my gosh, in IE9, it's terrible. And what, you know, what we do, typically it's JavaScript that's the problem, because JavaScript is kind of the interactive language of the web that makes everything move, and that's the thing that's always had the most problems from support standpoint. What we have on the web is we have technologies called polyfills, and then it's just kind of a fancy term for fallback. So that website I mentioned earlier, caniuse.com, which tells you, hey, you can absolutely use CSS animations in these browsers. Well, that site also suggests fallback support if you need to support older browsers. There's another kind of companion site to that called HTML5please.com. So HTML5please.com. And that site does the same thing. Like, you kind of pick your technology, like in CSS animations or video. You know, non-flash, just straight-up web video, and tells you what browsers support it, and then also, hey, here's this little library that you can include so that it works in other browsers that don't support it. And because that's kind of what we have to do, is we have to build for the modern browser and then kind of build progressively enhanced so that even under the most extreme conditions or older browsers, we have some sort of way to support, you know, those people.
So to Loftus' point in the chat, a couple years ago, you know, we were building apps, and then it was HTML5. So we're going to do HTML5, but that didn't work, and so everybody went back to apps.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking more browsers. Are we moving back to that, or is this going to be a hybrid state where you have some native and some in the browser, and it's just kind of, it depends on the developer and what they want to do?
Yeah, that, you know, the momentum of switching back to the browser, you know, was derailed a little bit just by browser support, because, you know, we have huge organizations that are literally still using IE8, you know, and IE8 is, you know, less than, I think right now it's less than like 4% of the worldwide total, but, you know, if you work for a major company, all 8,000 people in that company might have IE8. And so even though that's a very small number, you know, from a worldwide standpoint, that's a very large number as a developer of that, for that company. And so that's why, you know, the app thing is kind of where we're at. It's kind of like the thing that works the best. But more and more, as these browsers have advanced and have, and as the browser vendors have moved toward a more progressive deployment model, you know, and again, by that I mean, like, you know, Chrome and Safari, every few days there's an update. You know, there's another version available. Edge is moving to that model where they can be pushing out background updates that are security fixes, bug fixes, new support for web APIs. That can keep up with the pace of technology, and that can begin to spur more, you know, creativity in the way we deliver our content.
Yeah.
Is there going to be like in this new, I think there's a culture that's going to happen, because I definitely use a mix of web and apps, you know, mm-hmm. and my biggest example, the one time I go to the web is to order food, right? Because most of my food places around me, at least the small ones, don't have their own app, or their app's terrible, actually worse than the web.
Yep.
So I use the web for that. But to be honest, if I am looking for anything that I think would actually be anything more than ordering food, anything that would take more than me inputting data, I'm instantly going to the App Store. I don't even open up a web browser. Usually I'm opening up the App Store saying, hey, do they have an app? Because it'd probably be the best way to do it. So if we're moving back to the web, I mean, we're going to have a huge culture change to kind of retrain people. Hey, you don't need to go to the App Store anymore. Now you can just go to your web. You know, it might be easier, but we're going to have to shift everyone's way they already do things.
Well, and it's, you know, I think that shift that you know, it depends on the user a little bit, because, you know, a lot of times the way that I get pushed into an app is because I'm on their site, and then I get that, like, annoying little drop down at the top that says, are you sure you don't want to download our app and look at it? And again, most of the time I'm like, no, I'm just trying to read this news article. Like, I don't want to download your app to read this news article that someone, you know, tweeted out that is on, you know, like a news website that I don't need to follow. Like, I just want to read it. But that kind of barrier for people to get into an app is a very easy way to, like, hey, download our app. Oh, yeah, there's an app to download. Well, those will slowly disappear as websites become more and more available. You know, the New York Times, I believe, does not allow their site to be viewed on desktop inside of their building. So they make everybody, if you work for the New York Times and you're on their corporate network, you have to view their website on your phone or your tablet. They do not allow desktop viewing of it. And they're doing that so that the content producers and the people who are actually building the site and adding content to the site recognize how to use that medium effectively, given, you know, this device kind of, you know, agnostic world that we're in right now, because you get too comfortable on the desktop and you recognize that we need to make this work everywhere. Like, that's really the easiest path in the long run, is that if the site just works everywhere, and people don't ever, like you're a perfect case of, you're like, I want the app because your site is terrible. Like, give me the app because I'm sure it'll work a lot better, and it normally does right now. Well, eventually we want to be to the point where the website meets every need you want, because it just intuitively works, and that we're not there yet, which is why apps are still a popular way to go.
Microsoft has this new concept of Continuum coming. And today it's available. We see it most in the Surface Pro and the Surface line, because you can disconnect the keyboard and it changes status, right?
Yep.
That's just the early stages of Continuum. They have big plans to think about developing, no matter what you're doing on a device, that device can get plugged into another device, or it senses another device, or it powers another device. I'm around monitors, it's going to power those up. From a developer standpoint, where you're at today, is that even showing up on your radar when we think about development and the interactivity of hardware with other bits of hardware?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that point really coincides with something that Lotta was saying there about how, that was kind of a specific example that you said, like with forms on the web, how, you know, they're terrible with mobile standpoint because you aren't able, they're hard to type in, they're zoomed really weird. And the concept of, like, changing context from going from a keyboard with your tablet to undocking your tablet, and all of a sudden now you're in a touch context, or you're gonna work off of another piece of hardware. We need to do interface design that accommodates that, and then can adjust to the What if you don't have a mouse? Well, you know, every button you put on the web right now should be at least 44 pixels by 44 pixels, because that's the minimum size for a finger to be able to tap it effectively. Any smaller than that, and it, you know, you have to like pinch and zoom to get at that button to try to hit it. And that's on us as developers. That's on us as designers to say, we've got to build for that lowest common denominator. Start out, build mobile first, and build our content to work so that, and the user adds a keyboard, or they're interfacing with their TV, or their, you know, the wall, you know, is now where the picture is being projected or being used. We need to be able to work with those mediums, and if we do it right design-wise, we should be able to accommodate that.
So along those lines, Apple's had a big product this year with their watch, and you decided not to go with that, but you have a Pebble watch, one of the new ones. You want to hold that
up? I do.
Tell me a little bit about that. I'm not as familiar with that one.
So Pebble did a Kickstarter about, I want to say, 3 years ago. They came out. They were like the first smartwatch really to, and they did. It was we want to raise $100,000, and they raised like $50 million. You know, it was like the. I think to this day, it's still the most successful Kickstarter. So they just went with the second iteration. So this is the Pebble Time. And there's a time, and there's a time steel, which is just like the pro version of it. It's a little fancier. But so I did the Kickstarter this time around because I liked that they had, you know, this is version 2, so they've got some time in the water, and they've been able to adjust it. And it uses e-paper as the display. So it's actually a color e-paper display, which, you know, it might be kind of tricky to show up. You kind of see, like, as I'm going through the calendar here, you can see the little blue bar on the side. Like, it's actually a color display, but it's e-paper, so it's really easy to see in sunlight. It's really low battery power because it's not an LCD display. I get about 5 full days of use. It uses low power Bluetooth for its connectivity to the phone. Not too much different from the Apple Watch from the standpoint of, like, you need to have a device. Like, you need to have a phone because it'll show every single notification that shows up on your phone, but you need to have a phone to be Bluetoothing the notification to you. So it's not, I can take it off on myself, and then it's just a regular watch, but, you know, what fun is that? The real selling point for me on it, not only because it was, you know, like less than half the price of the Apple Watch, and I feel like, you know, at, you know, $350 or $400, whatever the Apple Watch is, like, I'm going to want a different one in like a year and a half, and and that's, you know, I can't afford that. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it's a tough pill to swallow at that price point. I mean, Mike, you guys were just talking about that the other night. I mean, it's pretty expensive to go. So that retails in the $200 range?
Yeah, you'll have to check out Pebble. I think it's $199 for the time retail. You know, the Kickstarter was like $140 or something like that. So, but the thing that I like that they did with it is the hinges are actually data connectors. So third-party vendors can make bands that extend the watch. So, for example, you can get, like, they're in the process of making a battery band. So if you're going to go to Africa for 2 months, you know, shooting video of things, and you're just not going to want to have to plug this in all the time, you can literally buy a band that will be a battery, or like a fitness band or a GPS band, you know, things that will add to the watch without them having to actually put it in the watch. So that longevity kind of, I said, like, okay, cool. Well, even if the watch doesn't do that much out of the box, you know, it you can get bands to continue to extend the life of it and make it more useful for situations. So I've liked it. I've been pretty happy with it.
And they're publicizing that data connector?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's funny, because Apple has one in their band. I mean, it's covered up, but they actually have that connector in the Apple Watch, too, but they don't talk about it.
They don't talk about it at all.
And it's not open. Yep. You can't use it. It's strictly a diagnostics port for the Apple Store. But I'm wondering if in the future they're maybe setting that there to open it up later.
There's an article somebody wrote about it that said, like, it supports everything. Like, so you, with the Apple Watch, you would be able to use that if they would open up the SDK for it, so developers can figure out what it does.
But Apple, you know, they won't do that. No way.
Lopta's question there, to reiterate, it's e-ink for the display. So, yep, it's app, and I believe I believe it does work for Windows Phone. If not, like the app is coming out shortly, but they're planning on supporting Windows Phone as well with it.
Mike, you had mentioned on your show on Tuesday, Apple sales of their watches are down 90%. So, I mean, basically, Apple's going to be bankrupt, right, in the next
week or two.
That's the end of everything.
Yeah, and I think we did the calculation during the show, and they're still making like $7 million a day selling it, because it dropped down to 20,000 units a day is what they're selling right now, as compared to the, you know, in the millions that they sold on opening day.
I guess that tells you how successful it was on opening day.
Oh, yeah,
I wonder if we compared that to the band, to the Microsoft band, what we would see in numbers difference.
But, I mean, that shouldn't, on any of these products, that's not going to surprise anyone, right? Because it's not something you need, and it's something that initially you're going to have the big excitement for, and then everyone's going to either have it, not have it, wait till Christmas, or get version 2, really. I mean, at this point.
Well, and that was my fear with the Apple Watch was, you know, I mean, I'm a Mac Pro user. Like, I've been in the Apple ecosystem for a while, and I trust them to make good things, but I just... You know, like one of the things during the keynote when they're talking about the cool dial, right? They like, you know, Johnny Ive was on there in his accent, like talking about how they reimagined the way that it will work, and you know, and then Kevin Lynch, who's a former Adobe guy, comes on, who's a product manager for it, and he's giving the tour of the watch, and all he's doing is using the screen the whole time. Like, he never touched the dial.
And that's all anyone I've ever seen used. I've not seen one person who has the Apple Watch use the dial.
And so I was like, you know, I just feel like version 2 is going to be a lot better than version 1. So, you know, and I mean, if I had, you know, $350 to burn or whatever, it'd be fun to try out. And having an iPhone... You know, the fidelity and the interoperability with it is really, really nice from what I've heard. But it's kind of one of those things that I didn't want to be the test case.
Right. Well, and when I saw the whole new, you know, the crown, whatever it's called, I'm like, oh, that's kind of a cool concept. And then I saw people not use it, and I wondered why. I mean, I don't have one of these. I'm like, why don't people use it? My buddy had a good take on it. He's like, because in the past, you've only touched that on a watch when you want to change the time. Like, you avoid it. You actually avoid at all costs pulling it out, bumping it. You don't want to turn it because then you're all off. He goes, so for years, I mean, since the watch has been around, we've learned not to touch that.
Yeah.
He goes, and now they want us to touch it all the time. And I'm like, that's a perfect reason why people don't use it.
Kind of take some re-social engineering to get people that. And you're talking about what used to be the winder, right?
Yep.
Yeah. It's funny. My dad had a Rolex that IBM gave him. He was an IBMer, and it was one of those self-winding. And so he'd come out in the morning just doing this with his... And he never touched it again. I mean, you set it and you forget it. So it's been a long time since we've messed with that. But I'm not... The new watch from Apple, the iWatch, none of that excites me, to be honest with you. In fact, I didn't wear a watch for 10 years. I picked up a Garmin 220 running watch, and that's kind of become, it's not dumb, because it's got a GPS and stuff, right? But
because it knows where it is.
It does what I need it to do, and it will tell me when my phone battery is low. But that's about all it does. That's, you know, and it moves my data from my watch, what I get when I run, onto the phone, which is pretty cool. But it's been one of those things. This has been really the really first with the watches, the first technology thing I haven't really wanted to get interested in. It's kind of like
I think my takeaway and really the thing, because I wasn't sure how I would like it, if it would be distracting, or, you know, I mean, it's a watch, right? Like, if the battery dies right away, like, it's kind of a pointless watch. But the notifications, I've really come to love, because, you know, it gives you a little haptic feedback, so you get a little buzz in your arm, but I don't have to fish my phone out of my pocket every time. And actually, I don't miss phone calls anymore, because I don't feel the vibration in my pocket. You know, I'm not like I don't like cell phone ringers, because, like, they go off and everybody hears them and they're really noisy. I just like to vibrate, you know.
And it was supposed to be vibrate. It was supposed to be quiet, right?
Yeah,
and
yet yeah.
We hear they're so loud now.
Yeah,
exactly. It's louder than the ring. You know,
the thing about having the watch and having the notifications there is it. You know, like, I'll be sitting out to dinner. I don't have to have my phone up on the table. I'll feel the buzz, or someone will be calling me, and I'll feel my phone start to buzz, and I can just kind of glance at my watch and see who it is and dismiss it, and, you know, or decide, like, oh, yeah, this is important. It's someone I got to talk, you know. But I kind of, it hasn't become a distraction. It's actually, like, separated me from my phone a little bit, which I like.
I'll be honest. I've become a little bit of a snob in this area. I don't have a job that requires it, so I don't have to be on call all the time. But I shut everything off all the time. Like, my phone ringer's not on. It's not. Since I got an iPhone in February, and even before that, when I was 4 years on Android, never once has my ringer ever been on, and never once has it vibrated. I answer it on my. It's like, if you call me, chances are I don't want to talk to you anyways. You're calling me, and I have to be like, the phone has to be there and up and it ringing, and I have a moment to answer it. So, I have completely gone the opposite direction with notifications, to the point I'm like, I will get back to you when it fits into my workflow, because oftentimes, otherwise, I mean, I'm distracted so easy.
Yeah.
And if that thing was buzzing on my arm, oh my God, I would never get anything done, because already I get an alert every minute based on, you know, my Yahoo email, my live email, my Gmail, the work email, the Periscope, Meerkat, right? They're all sending me. I get my phone would vibrate off the table. And so I've chose to ignore all notifications.
And that's definitely a case. That's a good point, because like I don't have email notifications turned on. I only have like Twitter retweets or favorites, you know, like that's the only time I get a notification there. It's because if I got notifications for every email, or you know, had a lot of social media things, it would be totally annoying, because it would be buzzing all the time, and that would then defeat the purpose.
Well, part of my job is social media, and so it would be, if I had that turn, those pieces, I've got stuff coming in all the time, and I kind of learn there's certain times I kind of watch it, and although I'm still bad about Facebook, and just check it, I see the red number, and I'm like, ooh, I got to check that, because part of my job is Facebook, and response time matters to my customers. In getting back to them. It's so, anyways, that's kind of, for me, that's been, Mike, how much, and I always forget, you know, you can actually set those notifications. I don't do anything. Like, I rarely customize my phone. I turn off the ringer. There's no vibration on. It's just like, if I want to call, I'll pick it up. I'll check it from time. And every 10 minutes or so, I check it. Mike,
I did it as part of my spring cleaning. So part of my, you know, where I go through my back everything, I just double check all my electronics. I do it about twice, maybe three times a year. I do a real big, deep digital clean. And I go into my notifications on my iPhone, and I just turn it, like, I realize every app pops up, can I send you alerts? And I just click yes, because I never know if I'm going to want them in the future. And I go through and I turn off almost all of them. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice. Once you turn off all of them, and especially once you turn off Periscope, Clamor, and some of the other ones that really get you good. Not that I don't like those apps, but I don't need to be alerted every time something happens on them. Yep. And once you do that, your notifications can almost turn into they're almost more useful than they ever have been in the past. So you just got to go through it. And it's one of those things, it's a pain. It's something no one wants to do. It's one of those tasks. It's just like, you know, cleaning the toilet. No one wants to do it. But once you do it, you're really glad you did. So,
amnesty day. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Dustin?
And for the iPhone users, the rule of thumb is when you download an app and then you start it up and the first thing it asks you, do you want to let it send you push notifications, you say no. Because typically you don't need push notifications. It's like the notifications will be there whether you need them or not, but you don't need them popping up every single time, you know.
Well, and for some people, there are really important things they need to be monitoring, and I get that.
Yep.
I get that from that perspective. So it's one of those things where I've just kind of chosen to live silently, and I really like it. And, you know, just tonight I was coming down prepping for the show, and somebody pinged me on Facebook Messenger. Hey, I tried to call you. And I was like, my phone got stuck. I got alerted. I was joking with somebody today that I get invites for Google Hangouts through Facebook Messenger. Right? They'll copy and paste that, but because it's where I'm at, right? That is something I kind of keep track of. And so people have learned, if you ever want to get a hold of me, find me on Facebook. That is a place I'm, because of work, again, I have to, it's part of my job to kind of monitor it. Mm-hmm. The other thing I've been getting into recently, and I don't know if you're into this at all, but Slack has been a kind of a communications tool. Have you, Dustin, have you tried out Slack? Are you guys using
it? Yeah, I use it with a couple clients that use it, and I really like it. Like, I want to get by company or, you know, by coworkers in on it, but we're small enough that it's like, you know, the learning curve of it might not be, I mean, it's not really a learning curve, but like it's hard to get buy-in from them to like basically ditch email altogether and just use chat, you know, because that's kind of what Slack does, is it really just allows you to organize everything, and I really like the paradigm shift, but it definitely is a paradigm shift.
Yeah, and I think we're used to threaded conversations, and that's one area Slack does not necessarily support very well, is the idea of threaded conversations. So you really got to shift your thinking, and I have a new group of, there's a couple hundred of them, and we're testing this out to kind of see if it's going to work for this large group. Not a lot of communication, but communication that needs to be referenced. I like the search feature in Slack, going back to it. But they are so used to the Yammer, the Facebook style of threaded conversations that are, I mean, if you could get Facebook search to work, the problem is it doesn't, right? You can't freaking find anything on Facebook once it's there. So we've been trying Slack out for that. I've got a group of podcasters that I actually talk to more now that were in our own Slack group than I would have the email. Just that didn't, like, this is where I'm finding Slack is good for those disparate groups where they don't work together. They're not co-located together, and where the conversation isn't overwhelming. I think that's where, if you're going to have this back and forth IM conversation, I think Slack, you're going to run into big problems with Slack because it's just too much comment in there.
Well, that's for organizing your channels, you know, within Slack and getting people disciplined that, like, okay, I've got a channel or hashtag for this project, and I got a hashtag for this project, and making sure people are commenting in there. Like, that's really where the power, becomes.
There's the problem. You said people and discipline.
Yeah.
We can't even get people to comment in their code, right? Much less make comments where they're supposed to make comments.
Yeah, Jim, you were talking about, so along the whole Slack line, you know, we've been talking for the past few weeks about doing, you know, a Patreon or something like that where you have a premium. Well, Mac Geek Gab, one of the most popular Mac podcasts out there, those guys have their Mac Geek Gab Premium, which is the people that pay a certain amount a month, and they have a special email they can email to, and they have their questions. But they're thinking about starting a Slack for those premium subscribers. I was like, what a great idea. An idea to get that group, and kind of an enticing thing, say, hey, we have this community out here. It's the kind of the pro users of our community. And I honestly haven't played with Slack ever yet, so I was thinking, man, I got to get that and play with it now that you guys brought it up.
Yeah, well, you know what? Maybe we'll create a little group and I'll invite you into it. It's good. You know, we have this group of podcasters, and then in that group of podcasters, I wanted to do a subset of a private team for Dave Jackson and I for Ask the Podcast Coach.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of those kinds of things where it's like, because there's times we just want to have a conversation. And so we started our own hashtag that's private between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're like, that's a perfect way to do it. And if I just want to talk to him, I can send him just that we have a channel, just he and I, if we want to do it that way as well. So it's pretty cool. If you haven't checked out, if you're listening to this and you haven't checked out Slack, it's just slack.com. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable that they got that URL. Somebody was holding on to that, and they named the product because they got the URL, right?
I think they paid big money. I don't think they had it.
But a new communications tool, kind of unifying a lot of IM and email, and kind of ditching email for the most part for team communication. And we have a podcasters group. I actually have two Gallup groups on it, and then the group of high school interns that we have, we're going to go on to Slack. That's next year. Slack is going to be the way that we communicate with the class. And it's dynamite because it works across all platforms, right? So iOS, Android, Windows, Windows Phone, and the desktop. You can get it anywhere. I mean, it's really pretty cool. The functionalities differ between the platforms, but pretty good. Check that out, Slack, indeed. Well, we've kind of... Dustin, this goes so fast.
It does. I can't believe it's quarter after nine already.
It is. as we kind of come up on our time here. But before, I've got a few announcements to do. Can you hang for just a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Thanks for doing that. Oh, we got to do one call. So this is Phil in the UK. And I promised that we would play this. So hang tight here one second. Phil's got a PST question, and I think I've got a quick answer to it. And so let's hear from Phil.
Oh, hi, Jim. I'm Phil calling from UK. My question is about what's the best way for an average guy to make his Outlook PST file available to all his devices? In my case, I could have a synchronized PST file on my Windows Home Server 2011, or I could have commercial cloud storage, or I could put it on my Western Digital MyCloud storage. But I'm not quite sure how to go about doing it. I don't have Exchange Server or Office 365, but I could get it, I suppose. I've just got individual copies of MS Outlook 2013, and I'd like all my devices to better access the same PST file. Jim, thanks for all that you do for us, and do keep up the good work. We really appreciate it. Bye for now.
That's pretty cool. Either you guys, I've got an answer, but either one of you guys want to take a shot at it before we do that? Dustin, you have any insights on that?
Well, my answer was going to be Office 365, just because like that's kind of the point of that service, because having it on a cloud storage solution would probably work, but I'm not like those. My experience with those Outlook files, like it, the second it gets corrupt, it's like it's gone, like it's like unrecoverable, and so like something that's actually a service that would be synchronizing it that way, I think that would be the best bet.
Yeah, and Mike, you admitted to us in pre-show you don't know anything about PSTs.
Never once encountered them, heard of
well,
them.
Well, if you use Outlook, PSTs, especially for the last 10 years, have been kind of the way you store data in Outlook, kind of outside of having an Exchange Server, right? And so a lot of folks, if you have an Exchange Server, typically you don't use PSTs unless you need extra storage where you're locked down on the Exchange Server, and so people can store those emails. And I don't know why people want to store emails. The best day ever in my life was when Gallup said, you're going to keep 90 days of emails, and then they're gone.
Yeah, they're gone.
And I was like, yes, right? Because there's liability, responsibility for that, right? There's e-discovery, and there's some lawsuit problems you get the longer you keep your files. And so you keep a policy of 90 days of email, and then when they come and say, we want to search all your email, you're like, I'm sorry, we have shredded it all, and that's our policy. And so a lot of companies are adopting that. But you can, a lot of people are very paranoid about losing their email, and so they move these off into PSTs. Phil, in this case, I'm gonna point you to msoutlook.info, right? msoutlook.info. This guy's a Windows MVP, or is a MVP for Microsoft. It's got some great information on doing it. You're using Outlook 2013. Up until recently, that was not supported as being able to connect to Outlook.com. My recommendation is that you go to Outlook.com at this point. Mm-hmm. But there's a new connector. You want to get some instructions, because it's a little wonky on how you make that connector between Outlook and Outlook.com work. But once you do that, you can, once you get the two connected, then you can start moving all those mail that's in folders, so you pull it all into Outlook so you can see it. So connect those PSTs so you can see them in Outlook. Then you just move those folders, everything except the main folders, the send, sent, trash, some of those things. You can't migrate those that way. You'll have to manually move those things over into those folders to get them done. But that should sync right into Outlook.com and get all your stuff, get it all in the cloud, and then be done. And I get why he's on Outlook. I love Outlook as a tool, the client. Mm-hmm. I love it on an Exchange server.
Yeah.
Right? If I did it at home, that's not my favorite place to have it. But I do like when I work, Outlook is a big part of my workflow. And so I get, some people say, God, don't use Outlook. But I get it. It's a great Outlook 2013 for some people. For me, I'm one of them, a great productivity tool. And I just use the heck out of it. I'm so used to it. The Outlook web clients that Microsoft have are terrible. They don't work very well. Outlook.com is a little hobbled. It's not, they did a bunch of development on it, and then I think they all went to Windows 10 because it hasn't moved in a while. Right? Looks exactly the same today as it did 2 years ago. But that being said, Phil, I think move that stuff to the cloud. Check out msoutlook.info, and they've got a lot of information for you out there, and another way to do it as well. Thanks for calling in, Phil. All right, with that, a couple reminders. One, if you haven't signed up for the newsletter, love to have you do that. I'm actually still late on the newsletter. It's just one thing I haven't gotten to. But you can get signed up for it at theaverageguy.tv. Just a reminder, the meetup that we're doing in Indianapolis on September 12th is in full swing. So if you haven't done it, head out to the show notes. We'll have a link to get signed up for the meetup. It is September 11th and 12th. That's a Friday and Saturday in Indianapolis. Yeah, you have to travel there. Hotel's about $100, and it's $25 to get in the conference. But we always have a great time, And so if you want to do that, click on the link out there as well and to get signed up for that. And then one final reminder, I'm live every Saturday morning, Ask the Podcast Coach, Dave Jackson, call-in show. It's a lot of fun. If you haven't listened to a call-in show on the web like we do it live, that's a lot of fun. You should come out one morning just to see what we're doing out there. AskThePodcastCoach.com/live, 9:30 Central, 10:30 Eastern. And I'd love to have you out there. Dustin, we'll do a post show, so hang tight. But thanks for coming out, and great to be with you tonight.
My pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
No, it is a lot of fun. We'll have you back. If I ask you back more often, would that be all right?
I'm always available, yeah.
Yes. I love it. Mike, thanks for taking my faithful co-host there. Thanks for jumping in and in the conversation tonight.
It's not a week unless we have Home Gadget Geeks. I felt naked last week. Like, it was weird. It was like my week didn't come to an end. It was just from Tuesday to, like, this last Tuesday at all.
Well, you didn't podcast, and I didn't podcast, and Dave didn't podcast, and it was a weird week not to have any live podcasting.
I think my wife was wondering why she was seeing me so often.
She's like, can't you just go podcast? Go. Just get out of my hair. We are live out here every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, out at theaverageguy.tv. Live. Love to have you join us. I want to say thanks to everyone in the chat as well. Great chat room tonight. You guys are rock stars. It's the same guys every single week, but we appreciate the conversation that you bring out as well. And with that, we'll say goodnight, everybody.